Welcome everybody. This is the second lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, organized and hosted by the Numoda Center of Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Arts in Taiwan. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Raiko Onuma, who will be speaking to us on the topic of mothers and motherhood in Indian Buddhist literature. Raiko Onuma is an associate professor in the Department of Religion at Dartmouth College in the United States, where she has been teaching courses on Buddhism, Hinduism, and religious studies since 1999. Her research focuses on Sanskrit and Pali Buddhist literature, especially narrative literature, and she's the author of two books, one called Head, Eyes, Flesh and Blood, Giving Away the Body in Indian Buddhist Literature, and another called Ties That Bind, Maternal Imagery and Discourse in Indian Buddhism. She is currently working on her third book, which will be about animals in the Indian Buddhist imagination. In fact, she personally just told me it has been accepted for publication, so we all very much look forward to her book. And now I disappear and leave us to Raiko Onuma's presentation.
Okay. I think I've turned the sound on. Thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you also for inviting me to be part of the course again this year. I participated in the course last year and found it to be a very enjoyable experience, so I'm quite happy to be back again. I have Ganesh over this shoulder, making sure that our proceedings are auspicious, and I have Burmese Jataka depictions over this shoulder. So the title of my lecture is Mothers and Motherhood in Indian Buddhist Literature, and I thought I would start by placing my lecture within the context of the course as a whole. So this is a course on Asian Buddhist women, and in looking at the syllabus, I can see that future lectures will be dealing with actual Asian Buddhist women, whether in Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Japan, China, or Tibet. So one thing I wanted to emphasize right away is that my lecture is not dealing with actual Buddhist women. Instead, it's dealing with textual representations of women, and more particularly textual representations of mothers in Buddhist literature from India. And in the case of mothers in particular, I think that's a really important distinction to keep in mind, because the images of mothers that we find in Indian Buddhist texts are really not realistic in nature. They never seem to me like real mothers. Instead, they are images that I think are using motherhood as a trope to convey certain Buddhist values. So sometimes these images are highly idealized. They are the kind of perfect mothers that one never actually encounters in real life. Sometimes these images can be very negative, and they might depict mothers that are cruel and terrible. But what they don't tend to depict is the messy complexity of an actual flesh and blood mother. So one question is, what are these images meant to convey? But a second question is, how do these images of motherhood from the text affect actual Buddhist women on the ground? And I think that's something that you all will have an opportunity to think about as the course proceeds. I think one of the interesting things about the course is that the first few lectures do focus primarily on textual representations of women, and then the course moves to women, actual Buddhist women on the ground. And so the challenge will be to think about the relationship between the former and the latter. So with that as a brief introduction, I want to move on now to the first of several different topics I want to discuss today. And I think the procedure I would like to follow is to just give my lecture without interruption, unless you have a really pressing question. It's better for the flow if I just give the lecture. I will leave plenty of time at the end for questions and comments. Okay. How do I make this? Oh, here. Sorry. Okay, so I want to begin by noting that in many contexts in Indian Buddhist literature, the mother is treated in conjunction with the father, and no distinction is really made between them. So both parents are equally praised and celebrated, and children are understood to owe an enormous debt to both parents, a debt that is almost impossible for them to repay. And just to give you one example here, in a passage from the Anguttara Nikaya, the Buddha says, mothers and fathers do much for their children. They take care of them and nourish them and show them this world. And then he goes on to say, if a man were to carry his mother on one shoulder and his father on the other shoulder for as long as he lived, and if he were to anoint and massage their bodies, bathe them and knead them, while they were to urinate and defecate all over him, and even if he were to establish his mother and father in kingship over this entire great earth, even so, monks, he would not repay or requite his mother and father. So in this and many other canonical and commentarial passages, both parents are exalted equally and no distinction is made between them. In other contexts, however, I think we begin to see two things. So first of all, we see that the mother is sometimes slightly elevated over the father, often in a rather subtle manner. So, for example, in the commentary on the previous passage, the passage about the son carrying his parents around on both shoulders, we are told that the mother should occupy the right shoulder while the father should occupy the left. And, of course, in India, the right side is always the auspicious and highly favored side, whereas the left side is inferior. So we have this slight elevation of the mother. Another example of this kind of favoritism shown toward the mother is that in the list of the five sins of immediate retribution, or in Sanskrit, anantarya karma, which are for Buddhism the most heinous sins of all and that lead to an immediate rebirth in hell, both matricide and parricide, that is to say, killing the mother and killing the father, are included in that list of the five worst sins. But Buddhist sources almost uniformly rank the murder of a mother more severely than that of a father. So again, we see this slight elevation of the mother over the father. And this is typical, I would say, not only of Buddhism, but really of Indian thought more generally. So, for example, we have a famous statement from the Laws of Manu, or the Manava Dharma Shastra, which says that the teacher is 10 times greater than the tutor, the father is 100 times greater than the teacher, but the mother is 1,000 times greater than the father. So various contexts in which the mother is more important than the father. And then a second thing that we see, which I think is more important here, is that even though both mother and father are celebrated, the mother is especially celebrated because of the love that she has for her children. It's not so much what she does for them or how she provides for them. It's really the fact that she loves them so intensely. And in many Buddhist texts, mother love is highly idealized, and it's presented as the purest, most compassionate, most self-sacrificing type of love possible, much more so, I would say, than the love of the father. Now, I could give you many different examples of this extreme idealization of mother love, but one of my favorite passages comes from the Sonananda Jataka, where the Bodhisattva is a wise man named Sona, who is teaching his younger brother Nanda about the duty to take care of one's parents. And even though he's presumably talking about both parents, and he actually says that he's talking about both parents, in actual fact, he focuses almost solely on the mother. And when he describes what the mother does for her child, it's a very intimate, I would say, almost erotic description. So this is just some of what he says. He says, even before the child's conception, the mother anxiously worships the gods and questions the stars and the seasons, wondering under which constellation will a long-lived son be born. Once she becomes pregnant, she immediately gives rise to love for the offspring in her womb, and once the baby is born, she soothes her crying child with breast milk and lullabies, nestles him in between her breasts, suffuses him with the touch of her body, and wraps him up in the cloak of her arms. She pleases and appeases him, protects her innocent child from frightful wind and heat, treats him with tenderness, and looks at him with a loving heart, etc., etc. There's actually a long description of how she keeps worrying about the welfare of her son, even well into his adulthood. And then later on in the same story, this description of what a mother is like is actually brought to life before our eyes. Because the younger brother, Nanda, leaves home for an extended period of time. And when he comes back and is reunited with his mother, the text tells us that his mother goes to him and embraces him, smells and kisses his head, and extinguishes the grief in her heart. And then she says to him, "Seeing Nanda at long last, my heart trembles like the tender shoot of a fig tree fanned by the breeze." So even though both mothers and fathers are celebrated, it's really only the mother who is associated with these very intimate and eroticized emotions. And in fact, we often get the sense that it's really duty that ties one to the father, but it's love that ties one to the mother. The way that Alan Cole has described this in the case of medieval Chinese Buddhism is by saying that mother love serves as the emotional hook that guarantees the son's devotion to the patriarchal family. And I think much the same thing could be said in the case of Indian Buddhism as well. Now, it's also the case, moreover, that it is mother love rather than father love that is most often used as a religious metaphor. And this is where motherhood begins to come together with Buddhism and Buddhist values. So because mother love is considered to be the purest, most compassionate, most self-sacrificing type of love possible, in many Buddhist texts, it comes to serve as the most appropriate metaphor for the love and compassion that a Buddha or Bodhisattva radiates outward toward all sentient beings. And over again in countless Buddhist texts, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are said to love all beings just as a mother loves her only son. And the fact that this cliche is repeated over and over again, and that we really don't find any such statements involving, you know, fathers loving their daughters or husbands loving their wives and so forth, suggests that it really is the mother-son pair and the mother's love for the son in particular that is being idealized as an example of pure, compassionate love. We also find this metaphor used in discussions of loving kindness, metta in Pali and maitri in Sanskrit, which of course is a highly valued quality that one cultivates in Buddhist meditation, whether by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas or by ordinary monks. And here, one early and very classic example of the use of this metaphor comes from the Sutta Nipata, which says that just as a mother would guard with her life her own son, her only son, so one should cultivate an unbounded mind toward all living beings and loving kindness toward the whole world. I just realized that I totally misspelled loving there, and loving kindness toward the whole world. So again, mother love, and especially the mother's love for the only son, is here depicted as the very best model for the monk who wants to cultivate love and kindness. Now, clearly in passages such as this one, mother love is idealized, and it is depicted very positively. At the same time, however, one could also argue that it is undercut, and there is a sense in which the comparison with Buddhist values is really just a foil for the contrast. Because in fact, even though they can be compared to each other metaphorically, the love of a mother and the love of a Buddha or Bodhisattva are in many ways diametrically opposed to each other. So, for example, I don't know why that got messed up there, but a mother loves her own child alone, whereas a Buddha or a Bodhisattva loves all sentient beings equally. Another way of saying this is to say that the mother's love is particularistic in nature, whereas a Buddha's love is universal. And precisely because the mother limits her love to somebody who is particular to her, we can conclude from a Buddhist perspective that the mother's love is finally a form of selfish attachment. Conversely, because the Buddha's love is directed towards all sentient beings equally and with perfect equanimity, we can conclude that his love is selfless and is practiced with perfect detachment. So the treatment of mother love, in my view, ends up being highly ambivalent. On the one hand, mother love is celebrated as the most appropriate metaphor for the universal compassion of a Buddha. On the other hand, mother love as an actual entity and not as a metaphor is ultimately undercut and devalued. And it stands opposed really not only to the universal compassion of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, but also to the perfect detachment of the Arhat. And in fact, we do find in many contexts when it's not being used as a metaphor, that mother love comes to be depicted as the most potent manifestation possible of desire, attachment, and clinging. Or in other words, everything that keeps one bound within the realm of samsara. So I would like to look now at three different passages that illustrate this ambivalence surrounding mother love. My first example is a particular narrative motif that exists in both Hindu and Buddhist versions. And I think that the subtle difference between the Hindu and Buddhist versions illustrates this Buddhist ambivalence toward mother love. So the motif itself is that of a man who becomes the father of several sons. And then, for one reason or another, he is later transformed into a woman. And as a woman, she becomes the mother of several more sons. And the question is then asked, which sons do you love more? Those of which you are the father or those of which you are the mother? Basically, this is a way of comparing the intensity of mother love to the intensity of father love, and making that comparison really sharp by having the same person be both the mother and the father. So this is the motif. We have a Hindu version of this motif in the Baudayana Shrauta Sutra. And there we find that the person in question has more love for the sons of which she is the mother than she does for the sons of which she is the father. And the text itself explains this by saying that sons are dearer to a woman. So here we find that the message is quite straightforward. Mother love is always greater and more intense than father love, even when the same person is both the mother and the father. So that's a Hindu version of this narrative motif. Now let's look at a Buddhist version of the same motif as it appears in a story from the Dhammapada commentary. So here, once again, the person is asked which sons they love more, the ones of which they are the father or the ones of which they are the mother. And the person answers by saying, "Friend, I have a stronger love for those sons who were born from my womb." So just as we saw in the Hindu version, we're getting the message that mother love is greater than father love. But the Buddhist version does not end there as the Hindu version does. Instead, the Buddhist version goes on to say that the person in question, who is a man named Soreya, feels ashamed at having given this reply. And as a result of shame, he becomes a Buddhist monk, he withdraws into meditative solitude, and he quickly attains nirvana and becomes an arhat. And from that point onward, whenever people ask him that same question, "Which sons do you love the most?" he answers by saying, "I have no love at all for anyone." So the difference here may be subtle, but I think it is rather striking in its implications about mother love. Gone is the simple celebration of mother love, and in its place we get a more ambivalent message, which says that yes, mother love is greater and more intense than father love, but number one, that's something to be ashamed of, and number two, the fact that it is more intense means that it's only that much farther away from the perfect attachment of the arhat who has no love at all for anyone. Clearly, it is the father that is closer to being like an arhat than the mother, and that's manifested by the father's lesser attachment to his children. And then I think we should also take notice here of the actual verse from the Dhammapada that this story is commenting on. At the end of the story, the Buddha pronounces verse 43 of the Dhammapada, which says, "Neither mother nor father nor any other relative can do that which a well-directed mind can do far better." So in other words, when it comes to attaining nirvana, or the ultimate goal of the Buddhist path, all familial bonds are a hindrance, and since the bond with the mother is greater, it constitutes more of a hindrance. It's a greater obstacle to overcome. So if we take this story as a whole, I don't think mother love is being celebrated, or it's being partially celebrated, but from an ultimate perspective, it is also being undercut. Okay, a second passage I want to look at. If it is the case that mother love constitutes an especially potent hindrance to the attainment of nirvana, then we can also say that one who does attain nirvana might be compared to a mother who has eradicated all mother love from her heart. And in fact, this is precisely the comparison that we find in a passage from Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga. So this is a little bit complicated, but what happens in this passage is that Buddhaghosa is talking about a fairly advanced stage of meditation, and he says that in this stage of meditation, the meditator observes that all phenomena of the past, the present, and the future are impermanent, and he comes to realize that the impermanence of phenomena in the past has caused him suffering, and the impermanence of phenomena in the present is causing him suffering. Therefore, he makes a conscious decision to remain completely detached from all phenomena in the future in order to bring about an end to suffering. So this is the basic point that he's making. And in order to illustrate this point, Buddhaghosa then makes use of two comparisons. The first comparison is to a mother accompanying her three sons to the execution ground. And here he says, seeing that her oldest son's head had been cut off and that her middle son's head was being cut off, she let go of any attachment for her youngest son, thinking this one too will be just like them. So here, you know, you have this very disturbing image of a mother who has suffered intensely because she loves her sons and she has watched two of them die. And in order to avoid this suffering in the future, she lets go of any attachment to her last remaining son. In other words, you know, obviously from a Buddhist perspective, this makes sense. Attachment leads to suffering and we should let go of attachment. But really what's happening here is that an ordinary mother who loves her children is becoming a symbol of delusion and suffering, while the mother who banishes all mother love from her heart is becoming a symbol of enlightened detachment. Buddhaghosa goes on to make a second comparison, again involving mothers. This one is to a mother who becomes pregnant with a son 11 times in a row, the first 9 of them stillborn, the 10th one dying in her arms, and the 11th one still in her womb. And here he says, seeing that 9 of her babies had died and the 10th was dying, she let go of any attachment for the one in her womb, thinking this one too will be just like them. So here again, we get this very vivid imagery of pregnancy, repeated stillbirths, a baby dying in its mother's arms, to illustrate the kind of absolute incompatibility between mother love and enlightenment. Okay, so that's the second passage. And then finally, a third passage that I want to look at also comes from Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga. And this one, I think, illustrates both the positive connotations of mother love and the fact that it is ultimately being devalued. So this is a passage on the 4 Brahma Viharas, which are 4 highly valued emotional states that one cultivates in Buddhist meditation and then gradually extends outward until they pertain to all living beings. And those 4 states are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And here, Buddhaghosa explains each of these 4 states by comparing them to some kind of mother-son love. Once again, we see this kind of fixation on the mother-son pair. So loving-kindness, he says, is like a mother's love for her baby son because she wants to nourish him and take care of him. Compassion is like a mother's love for her sick son because she wants to remove his suffering. Sympathetic joy is like a mother's love for an adolescent son because she rejoices in his successes. And equanimity is like a mother's love for her adult son because she knows that he can take care of himself and she doesn't get overly wrapped up in his affairs. So once again, we see that we have these highly valued Buddhist qualities, and the very best ways to explain them are through the metaphor of mother-son love. Here, what I think is really interesting is that within the schema of the 4 Brahma Viharas, it is equanimity, that is to say the calm, dispassionate, even-minded attitude toward all beings alike, that is considered to be the highest state. And in fact, each of the other 3 emotions is supposed to be cultivated until they themselves reach the state of equanimity. So equanimity is the highest of these 4 states, and yet equanimity, of course, involves universality. It is a state of even-mindedness toward all beings alike. And that universality stands in conflict with the particularity that is inherent to mother love. And I think we can see that awkwardness come out within Buddhaghosa's metaphor. Because on the one hand, mother love is a very natural metaphor for things like loving kindness and compassion. But on the other hand, the only way that he can extend this metaphor to the most highly valued state of equanimity is by citing the example of a mother who doesn't worry too much about her adult son because she knows that he can take care of himself. So in other words, only the weakest, most attenuated version of mother love can stand for equanimity. And it doesn't even work very well. The metaphor kind of falls apart when we get to equanimity. And I think the reason that it falls apart when we get to equanimity is because mother love is inherently bound up with particularity, exclusivity, and selfish attachment. Okay, so let me just kind of summarize everything that I have said so far about the Buddhist ambivalence toward mother love by quoting from myself, my own book. This is what I kind of conclude. On the one hand, mother love is idealized as intense, compassionate, and self-sacrificing in nature, made akin to the Buddha's love for all beings or the Buddhist meditator's cultivation of loving kindness, and consistently elevated above father love in this regard. On the other hand, mother love is negatively portrayed as being overly exclusive and ultimately selfish in nature, and is perceived as a pernicious form of attachment, keeping one bound within the realm of samsara. As metaphor, maternal love is idealized. As reality, it is ultimately condemned. So keeping this general ambivalence in mind, I want to turn now to a second topic which is directly related to the first, and that is the motif of the mother whose child has died, or in other words, the mother in grief. If mother love is perceived as an especially pernicious form of attachment, and if, according to Buddhism, all attachment must inevitably lead to suffering, then it stands to reason that the mother who has lost her child to death would serve as an especially powerful image of suffering. And I would argue that in Buddhist literature, this is indeed the case. The anguish of the grieving mother who's dearly beloved child has been cruelly snatched away by the jaws of death, especially in infancy or childhood, seems to serve as a kind of iconic embodiment of the suffering that afflicts all unenlightened beings within samsara. From a Buddhist point of view, moreover, there is really nothing noble or beneficial or redemptive about such intense forms of suffering. In fact, Buddhism, as the middle way, holds that a modicum of happiness and comfort is essential for making any progress in overcoming suffering. And those who are mired too deeply within suffering, such as animals or hell beings, lack the presence of mind that makes spiritual progress possible. And in fact, the mother in grief does seem to share the spiritually stunted status of lowly creatures such as animals. She's very often described with animal imagery. She's compared, for example, to the cow who has lost its calf or the female osprey who has lost her chicks and so on and so forth. This is actually how I came to write my third book on animals, because I noticed in the course of writing the second book that grieving mothers were so often described with animal imagery. And I became interested in how the spiritually stunted status of animals is used to illuminate the spiritually stunted status of the grieving mother. The mother in grief is also often described as being driven into an actual state of madness because of her grief. so that once again she lacks the presence of mind that is so central to Buddhist cultivation, and that alone makes any progress possible. So the mother in grief serves in Buddhist literature as a potent symbol or a privileged emblem of both suffering and delusion. And yet, we do find that even a mother overcome by hysterical grief is capable of turning the corner and eventually attaining nirvana, as long as she is given the proper resources in the form of the Buddhist Dharma. This, of course, is a consistent theme running throughout the Terigata of the Pali Canon. Out of the 73 poems attributed to the Buddha's early female disciples that are contained in the Terigata collection, 5 of them exhibit the same basic pattern. And the pattern is that a mother loses her child to death and is driven completely insane by her grief. She then encounters the Buddha or one of his disciples, who gives her a teaching that snaps her out of her grief and allows her to regain control of her wayward mind, whereupon she becomes a Buddhist nun and goes on to attain nirvana. So the optimistic message here is that even the most iconic embodiment of suffering possible is able to benefit from the Buddhist Dharma. And in that sense, the Buddhist Dharma is a wonderful treasure. What I'm especially interested in emphasizing here, however, is exactly how this dramatic transformation takes place. How does this iconic embodiment of suffering turn the corner and go on to attain the highest goal? And here I would make 2 arguments. Number one, it always seems to involve a movement from the particular to the universal, from the personal emotion of grief to the abstract truths of death and suffering, from the death of one particular child to the endless cycle of death and rebirth that characterizes the entire universe. So it's only when the mother's very personal emotion of grief has been transformed into an impersonal and analytical understanding of dukkha or suffering that she is able to regain her mind and eventually attain nirvana. Number 2, I would also argue that this transformation is made possible only by erasing the specific identity of her deceased child, permanently severing the mother-child bond, and eradicating her status as mother. In fact, I would describe this as a kind of demothering of the mother. She has to lose her status as mother in order to attain nirvana, because motherhood by its very nature is incompatible with that state. So I want to briefly summarize just 3 of these accounts from the Terigata in order to demonstrate the consistency of this pattern. That is, the movement from the particular to the universal and the violence inflicted upon motherhood in the process. Okay, so we have one mother named Ubari who loses her daughter Jiva in infancy. She's overcome with grief. She goes to the cremation ground every day crying and lamenting for her lost child. And she's only brought to her senses when the Buddha confronts her in the cremation ground and tells her that within her previous lives, 84,000 daughters, all of them named Jiva, have been consumed in this cremation ground. For which among them do you mourn? So in this case, we have one particular dead daughter named Jiva being placed within the context of an endless series of dead daughters named Jiva, right? That one particular Jiva is losing her identity as Ubari's specific child. Moreover, if we also remember that Jiva is a noun meaning living being, then we can see that, in fact, Ubari's particularistic grief over one daughter named Jiva is being transformed by the Buddha into a detached appreciation for the impermanence of all jivas, the impermanence of all living beings. And yes, this does bring Ubari's suffering to an end, and it does allow her to attain nirvana. But it's also a transformation that Ubari herself describes with the sharp imagery of an arrow being plucked out of her heart. And I would argue that the arrow here is not only her maternal grief, it is also her maternal love. And it's only by eradicating this love completely that Ubari can be saved. In other words, she must be demothered. We have another mother, the famous nun Padachara, who in very quick succession loses her husband, her two sons, her parents, and her brother. She goes completely insane out of grief. She starts wandering around naked, while people throw dirt and rubbish on her in contempt. And she too is brought to her senses by the Buddha with a statement that once again aims to universalize the particular. So in this case, the Buddha says to her, "Sister, get a hold of yourself. For just as you are now shedding tears on account of the death of your sons and so on, so also the tears that have been shed within this round of rebirth without beginning or end on account of the deaths of sons and so on is greater than the water of the four great oceans." So here we get this kind of physical image of a single woman's tears being lost or swallowed within an ocean of water, and thereby losing any specific identity. Once again, however, this is also a transformation that requires her family to lose their particular identities and their particular relationships to her. And here I would contrast two different statements made by Padachara. Earlier in the story, when she is still in the midst of her grief, she says, "My sons are both dead. My husband is dead on the road. My mother, father, and brother have been cremated in a single heap." Later on in the story, once she's become a nun and she's close to attaining nirvana, one day she is washing her feet with a pot of water. And as she pours the water out, she sees that some trickles of water go a little distance, others go a further distance, and yet others go further still. And she says to herself, "Just as this water is subject to destruction and loss, so too are the conditions resulting in life for living beings." Right? So now, instead of the personal and relational language of my sons and my husband and my parents, we get the impersonal language of life-forming elements that are destroyed in either youth or middle age or old age. So her family has become an abstraction, and that means that her own status as a mother has been eradicated. Finally, we have a third mother, the famous Kisa Gotami. I'm sure everyone is familiar with the story of the mustard seed. Kisa Gotami loses her baby son. She goes mad with grief, and she starts carrying the baby's corpse around with her everywhere that she goes, asking people for medicine that will bring her son back to life. Finally, somebody sends her to the Buddha, and he says that he will give her such medicine if only she can bring to him some mustard seed from any household that has never experienced death. So she goes from house to house to house, but of course she cannot find any such household. In fact, at the very first household she goes to, the people say to her, "Who can count those who have died here?" So here I think we get a very concrete image of the process of universalization, because as she wanders from house to house to house, her particularistic grief is being gradually universalized into an analytical understanding of dukkha. And then once she finally comes to her senses, the statement that she makes to the Buddha again demonstrates this movement from the particular to the universal. She says to the Buddha, "This is not the doctrine of a village, the doctrine of a town, nor the doctrine of a family. This is the doctrine for the whole world of human beings and gods. All of this is impermanent." Once again, like Ubari, she describes this transformation with the imagery of an arrow being plucked out of her heart. And in this case, the Dhammapada commentary's version of the story, I think, actually makes it clearer to us that that arrow represents not only her maternal grief, but also her maternal love. Because it tells us that at that moment, her heart, which had been soft with mother love, grew hard. So again, she succeeds in attaining the highest Buddhist ideal, but only by inflicting violence upon her own motherhood. Now, one thing I want to emphasize here is that from a certain kind of feminist perspective, I think these stories are worthy of celebration, because in all of these stories, the Buddhist tradition expresses genuine concern for the life experiences of young women and sympathy for grieving mothers and a sincere belief in the ability of such women to transcend their suffering and realize their full potential beyond the function of motherhood. And in a sense, I think the Buddhist tradition's ambivalence toward mother love is directly related to its willingness to view women as something other than mothers and as autonomous subjects who, and thereby it leaves open other possibilities for women to pursue. All of that is worthy of celebration. On the other hand, however, I would also say that there is something very masculinizing about this discourse, and there is a sense in which a distinctively female voice is being silenced. And the way that I want to bring this point out or make this argument is by saying a little bit about very interesting article by the scholar Susan Starr Sarid. The article is called Mother Love, Child Death, and Religious Innovation. And in this article, Sarid is talking from a comparative and cross-cultural perspective about the death of children and the profound existential crisis that this causes for many mothers. Perhaps more so than it has traditionally caused for fathers, simply by virtue of the fact that women tend to be more heavily involved and invested than men in the nurturing and care of children. And what Sarah tells us is that the death of children often leads their grieving mothers into a greater involvement with religion. And that one persistent pattern of this involvement is that many women become dissatisfied with the interpretations of their child's death offered to them by the dominant patriarchal religions of the cultures in which they live. And instead, they often choose to become the leaders and members of various alternative religious traditions dominated by women. And here she gives a number of examples of such women-dominated religious traditions from around the world. Now, why do they turn from one kind of religion to another? Well, according to her, what many of these women-dominated traditions share in common and what makes them so appealing to mothers in grief is the possibility they offer of reestablishing contact with deceased children and maintaining regular ongoing relationships with them thereby denying the finality of death and the complete severance of the mother-child bond. And according to Sarah, this stands in contrast to the tendency of dominant patriarchal religions to interpret child death in abstract and universal terms, terms that sever the interpersonal mother-child relationship and erase the identities of specific deceased children. Here she uses a particular phrase that really struck me and just reminded me so strongly of the nuns of the Therigata. She says that from the perspective of these dominant patriarchal religions, the problem with these grieving mothers is that they insist on grieving over particular dead babies rather than dead babies in the abstract. In other words, they cling to the particular, they cannot rise above the particular, they fail to universalize their grief and turn it into something abstract and analytical, and that makes their response to the deaths of their children somehow insufficient or inferior. As a feminist scholar, however, Sarah says that she wants to resist traditional models of religion that automatically favor the abstract over the specific and the universal over the particular, and correspondingly men over women. And instead, she wants to treat women's religious responses to the deaths of their children with the seriousness that she thinks they deserve. So this is the line of thinking that leads me to see the demothered nuns of the Therigata as a very masculinizing take on mother love. And one thing that I would point out here is that in all of these poems, we find that mother love has to be eradicated rather than extended or transformed. So Kisa Gotami, for example, does not take her love for her son and then extend it to encompass all other beings. Instead, her heart must grow hard. So the particular and the universal here are in outright opposition, rather than imagining that maybe the particular could grow into the universal. So that makes me wonder, is there another way of depicting this? Why can't maternal love be seen as the basis for universal compassion rather than as its greatest impediment? And would it be possible to give Buddhist compassion an alternative genealogy so that it becomes reconcilable with the love of the mother? Well, in order to point to one place where this possibility is perhaps suggested, I want to look now at the story and cultic practice surrounding the figure of Harati. And basically what I'm trying to do here is to contrast the demothering of the nuns of the Therigata with what I would characterize as a much more willing accommodation of motherhood within the story and cult of Harati. So let me begin by summarizing Harati's story in case anyone is not familiar with it. It's found in a number of Buddhist texts from India. Harati is described as a yakshini, or a female demon, who lives in the city of Rajagriha at the time of the Buddha. She is married to the demon Panchaka, and together they have 500 sons, the youngest of whom is Priyankara, who is his mother's absolute favorite. Harati is a fairly cruel demoness who engages in the habit of stealing and devouring all of the human children of Rajagriha. So as more and more of their children die, the people of Rajagriha become increasingly desperate, and finally they turn to the Buddha for help. And he responds to their request by going to Harati's abode while she is out and hiding her youngest son, Priyankara, underneath his begging bowl. When Harati returns and she cannot find her youngest son, she is overwhelmed with grief. She cries and wails and beats her chest. She rips off all of her clothes. She searches the entire universe for him until finally somebody tells her to go to the Buddha. So up to this point, the story bears a striking resemblance to the stories of the Tarigata. Once again, we have a mother who is driven mad by her grief upon the loss of her child and who is finally brought to the Buddha. Once again, the Buddha snaps Harati out of her grief, but in this case, instead of doing so in a way that condemns and eradicates her mother love, he seems to do so in a way that draws upon her mother love and then encourages her to extend that same love to the children of others. So in one text, for example, he says to her, "Harati, because you no longer see just one of your 500 sons, you are experiencing such suffering. So what must be the suffering of those whose only child you take and devour?" In another text, he points out to her that others love their children just as you do, and they too go along the streets and lament just like you. And in another text, he says to her, "It is because you yourself love your own son that you eagerly run around demanding to see him. Why then, with such cruelty, do you continually devour the children of others?" So yes, her grief is being universalized, but in this case, it's not at the expense of her mother love. Instead, her mother love itself is being transformed and turned into something greater. And then we should also take notice of how the rest of the story goes. Once Harati's grief has been universalized and she agrees to stop devouring the human children of Rajagriha, the Buddha restores her beloved son back to her and she becomes a loving mother once more. And as a loving mother who is still concerned with her own particular children, she then asks the Buddha how she will feed her 500 children if they can no longer devour human babies. Whereupon the Buddha strikes her a bargain. Harati will be enshrined within every Buddhist monastery in India, and every day, Buddhist monks will make food offerings to her and her children after they finish their own meal. And in exchange for this, she must agree to do two things. Number one, she must protect all Buddhist monasteries from harm. And number two, she must respond to the pleas of childless parents by allowing them to have children, as well as curing children who are sick. So Harati agrees to both of these conditions, and from that point onward, she is described as a benevolent and protective goddess. Okay, so that in brief is Harati's story, and if we consider that story against the background provided by the Tarigata, then it seems to me that one way of interpreting the story is to see it as a rather complicated negotiation between the particularistic love of the mother and the universal ideals espoused by the Buddhist tradition. So on the one hand, Harati's grief over her own child must be universalized into an analytical appreciation of suffering in order for her to become a good Buddhist rather than a cannibalistic demon. On the other hand, however, once this occurs, she is allowed to have her child returned and her motherhood restored. And from then on, she manifests the Buddhist quality of universal compassion by giving children to other women and allowing them to experience maternal love too, while still continuing to love and protect her own children as well. It's also significant to notice here the role played by the Buddhist Sangha. The Sangha is full of those who have renounced all familial ties, but they depend for their health and safety upon the protective mothering of Harati herself. So now Harati's mothering is not only for her own children, but also for those who embody Buddhism's highest ideals. And conversely, the monks themselves also take on a somewhat motherly role because every day they feed Haruchi's children just as a mother would. So through this complicated negotiation, it seems to me that the concept of motherhood is being broadened so that a mother's mothering can extend to those besides her own children without compromising her special love for them, while those who are not literal mothers themselves can also mother society at large. And the end result of that is that the line between particularistic mother love and universal Buddhist values like detachment and compassion is maybe not such a strict line after all, and they aren't necessarily in outright contradiction. Now, if we pose the question of why this greater accommodation of motherhood is found in connection with the figure of Haruchi, I think one thing we can speculate is that the figure of Haruchi most likely has her origins not within Buddhism per se, but rather within South Asian folk religious tradition. In fact, she seems very similar in nature to many village goddesses and goddesses presiding over disease that are still worshipped on the folk level throughout South Asia today. And I would further speculate that that is a sphere of religion that was perhaps more accessible to women and reflective of women's concerns. And that any religious complex that is accessible to women is more likely to show a greater accommodation of motherhood and of the emotions of mother love. And then finally, the last point I want to make in order to wrap things up and also to point toward what this course is really about, which is actual Asian Buddhist women. I think we can also say that in the modern context, as women themselves gain more and more of a voice within the Buddhist tradition and greater power to envision Buddhist practice in new ways, I think we are likely to see not only an increasing accommodation of motherhood, but even perhaps a valorization of mothering itself as a legitimate form of Buddhist spiritual cultivation. And I want to leave you with a couple of modern examples where this does seem to be the case. So one example comes from Sid Brown's work on modern Thai Buddhist nuns, or Maichi. She talks about how because these nuns have a relatively low status in Thai society, they tend to be very dependent upon their families and deeply immersed within familial entanglements. And of course, this is unfortunate, the fact that they have this lower status. But according to her, rather than this situation being nothing but a hindrance, it does seem to have led these nuns to a particular vision of spiritual cultivation that is not necessarily shared in common with Thai monks. So this is what she says. It appears that Maichi are making a new role for themselves, combining the qualities of the ascetic role that are so admired of men in Thailand with those of the mother-nurturer role so admired of Thai women. And as a consequence, she says, many Maichi have become what she calls contemplative activists who engage in a variety of social campaigns that often focus on bettering the lives of mothers and their children. These nuns are what she refers to as renunciants who nurture, and their path is a new kind of spirituality, a woman's spirituality that is unique to nuns and not held in common with monks. So this would be one possible example of modern Buddhist women themselves spiritually valuing a kind of maternal love, seeing that love in Buddhist terms, and then extending that love to others as a form of Buddhist spiritual practice. Okay, and then my second example of modern Buddhist women making this type of move is, and I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce this, but the Qijigong Dehui, or the Buddhist Compassion Relief Foundation of Taiwan. I don't know a whole lot about this, but this is an organization that began in 1966 with a single nun and five of her female disciples and 30 lay women. So it was initiated by Buddhist women themselves. But today it is described as the largest civic organization in Taiwan, claiming 4 million members worldwide in 1994 and nearly 20% of Taiwan's population. It gives away well over $20 million in charity each year, runs a state-of-the-art hospital, and has branches in 14 countries. How has it achieved this level of success? Well, apparently it has achieved it through the basic strategy of encouraging Buddhist women to universalize their maternal instincts, to see those maternal instincts in terms of Buddhist compassion, and to forge a new identity for themselves as a kind of mother to the whole world. So that once again, maternal love and maternal emotions are not being treated as an impediment or an opposition to Buddhist ideals. Instead, they are serving as a legitimate basis for something higher and something better. And this is how one member of the organization describes this transformation, and I think this quotation is really striking, and it stands in such stark contrast to the nuns of the Terigata. She says, "I realized that I used to love too narrowly. I had only two children whom I was killing with my possessive love. And I was never happy with this aching love. But now I have so many children. I see everyone I help as my own child. I have learned that we have to make our mother love into a world love." So, you know, maybe this woman could be seen as a modern day version of Harati, and I think the whole way that mother love is treated here stands in fairly stark contrast to the Terigata. If we remember that the Terigata is the only text, really, in the Buddhist tradition, in the Indian Buddhist tradition, whose authorship has been attributed to women, and that it's a text that is canonical, that was accepted into the Theravada canon, then I think, you know, we could perhaps speculate that the only way it could achieve that canonical status was by presenting a very kind of masculinizing take on mother love, and one that accords with the interpretations of child death offered by dominant and patriarchal religious traditions, as Sarah has said to us. Nevertheless, the very fact that we also have within the Buddhist tradition this story and cult of Harati, the fact that it's there at all, perhaps suggests that an alternative understanding of mother love was present in pre-modern Indian Buddhism, but it can only be seen kind of in the shadows because of the male-dominated nature of that tradition. In the modern Buddhist world, however, as women do gain more and more of a voice, perhaps we will see an increasing accommodation between the love of the mother and the compassion of a Buddha. And I think this is apparent in certain figures. I don't know a lot about her, but I know that Deepa Ma Barua, I think her name is, famous Theravada, a woman who taught meditation, especially to many Americans, would often talk about, you know, taking care of your children and turning that into a meditative practice, treating housework as a meditative practice, picking up your kids from school as a meditative practice, and so forth, so that we get a very different approach to mother love and to the practice of motherhood than we might find in dominant, patriarchal, and canonical voices. Okay, on this slide, I just give you citations for the sources that I have referred to in the PowerPoint so that you can refer to them later if you wish. And with that, well, we have quite a bit of time left, 20 minutes left, but with that, I think that I will conclude, and I look forward to your questions and comments. So thank you. Bhikkhuni Dhamma Dina, Buddhist Compassion Relief Tsuchi Foundation, short name Tsuchi Foundation. Thank you. Yeah, I've just read one article about it that I just thought was so interesting, the way it tied in with what Susan Starr Sarad was saying. Okay, Deva Priya Ghosh says, do you think that mother love is greater than father love because of their inherent and standardized role towards their children, which creates much more attachment than the father? Do you think the realization of suffering is important to move towards nirvana? So for the first question, yes. I mean, I think, I don't want to argue that mothers love their children more than fathers do, but I do think it's pretty obvious to say that when you look cross-culturally throughout history and throughout the world, that mothers have been more heavily invested in the nurture and care and raising of children, and that this does tend to lead perhaps to more intense emotions than one finds in fathers. Actually, we can even see this in the Theragatha and the Therigatha. Catherine Blackstone, in her study, points out that whereas we find this grieving mother motif in 5 poems out of 73 in the Therigatha, we find no such similar grieving father motifs in the Theragatha, even though that one has, 500 different poems. And she notes in general that the poems of the Theragatha, the monks, pay a lot less attention to relational, social relationships with others in their pre-monastic lives and embeddedness within familial entanglement. So I do think there's a difference there that should be recognized. Okay, do you think the realization of suffering is important to move towards nirvana? Well, yes, of course, right? It's the first noble truth. I think the realization of suffering is absolutely crucial. On the other hand, again, why are only human beings able to attain nirvana? Because they have suffering, but not too much, right? If you're completely mired within suffering like an animal or a hell being, you just don't have the agency or the presence of mind to be able to think that there could be a solution. And that's where I see the mother in grief, the way she's depicted as being like a cow bellowing for its calf, or the way she's described as being driven insane by her grief. It does seem to me that that's a level of suffering where she becomes a symbol of a spiritually stunted being. And yet, again, if she's given the proper resources, she can turn the corner, and that is the great optimism of that motif. Okay, Stephanie Wachowicz. Thank you for the lecture. Often I read like a mother's love for her only child rather than her only son. Is that more a modern interpretation than an accurate translation of the old text? I would say that it is definitely in the original languages a son. It's a male noun, and there is a kind of real fixation on the mother-son unit. Not the mother-daughter unit, not the father-daughter unit, or even so much the father-son unit. Well, there is actually a lot of attention paid to the father-son unit, but doesn't have the same intense emotions surrounding it. The father-son unit tends to be more the focus of rhetoric, focusing on lineage and inheritance and things like that. Okay, Bhikkhuni Dhamma Dina, hello Reiko, a collective question from our class at Dharma Drum Institute of Liberal Arts here in Taiwan. Oh, that's nice. As discussed in this presentation, let me just scroll down here so I get the whole thing. As discussed in this presentation, women must abandon traditional aspects of womanhood, such as motherhood, in order to realize the highest Buddhist ideals. This has been characterized as a targeted attack on motherhood and thus women of a patriarchal religion. Yet men are also expected to abandon features of manhood, such as an active sexual life, as a prerequisite for reaching the highest goal. Men and women are both expected to abandon attachments traditionally associated with their genders, thus facing different challenges on the path to reaching the same androgyny or asexual state. In this light, should the requirement to abandon motherly attachment in the Buddhist tradition necessarily be interpreted as emanating from an anti-woman bias on the part of a patriarchal religion? So yes, I think this is a good point. Men and women are both expected to abandon certain features of manhood and womanhood. What I would argue, and this is drawing, I think, from a kind of a certain line of feminist thinking, is that the state of androgyny or asexuality or a universal state that lies beyond all gender is, in fact, implicitly coded as male, right? Oftentimes, it's pictured as a kind of disembodied state. We know that the mind tends to be associated with men and the body with women. So I think that whenever there is an appeal to the universal, to the abstract, to the androgynous, to the asexual, to that which lies beyond all gender, those things are implicitly coded as male. It's the man who stands for the universal. It's the man who stands for the abstract and the disembodied and so forth, because women have always been associated with nature, with the body, with sexuality, etc. And so, yes, from a certain perspective, there are demands on both sides, but I think given the, you know, worldwide history of patriarchy and sexism and so forth, it's very difficult to talk about a truly androgynous state that actually transcends gender connotations. So that's kind of where my argument is coming from. Okay, Tataloka Bhikkhuni. Stephanie, we do find in the text the word putta, here translated as son, being used by both fathers and mothers to their daughters. Well, okay, I take the primary meaning of putta really to be son, and I think that most of the stories are really about mothers and sons. The story of Ubari actually is interesting and stands out to me because it is a mother and a daughter, which is relatively unusual. So I always translate it as son. But thank you for that comment. Any other questions? As we're waiting for any other questions, let me just say that in my book, which is listed in the bibliography for this course, everything I've said today really comes from the book, but in addition, in the book, I have a rather long discussion of the Mothers of the Buddha, Maya and Mahaprajapati, and the particular ways in which I think they are functioning. I also have chapters devoted to how the imagery of pregnancy and gestation is used, and the imagery of breastfeeding. So all those things are dealt with in the book. Okay, Bhikkhuni Dhammadina says, another group question. Which Pali or Sanskrit word are you translating as the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas love? Well, it depends on which passage we're talking about, but in a general sense, karuna, their compassion. I wish I had it. I don't have it in front of me. But yes, I think it is important to point out that you know, sometimes maybe I'm translating as love words that could either be positively valued things like karuna or metta, or that could be negatively valued things like tanha, thirst, or clinging. And we can't just make all of those love. I guess what I'm trying to argue is that maternal attachment could still serve as a kind of basis for the development of a detached compassion by growing outward rather than being eradicated. But I agree with you that, you know, sometimes I'm a little bit slippery with how I translate these different words for the different emotions. Okay, Stephanie Wakowitz, I guess I've read a sutta, probably in the Majjhima Nikaya, about a sad father who visits the Buddha. The Buddha told him that love is dukkha, and he walks angrily away, but later someone explains it to him. Can anyone help to find or name the sutta? I don't know what that one is. Maybe somebody else does. Okay. Ravi Chandra Kumar Vijayan. Love is seen as a positive emotion in an existential outlook in our perspective in Dhamma. The experience of love on a personalized nature of mother love is the cause of suffering. So is love really a positive emotion? It shows attachment, selfishness, and goes against the calling of sabbe sata, not distinguishing one to the other. Yeah, I think from a Buddhist perspective, that love, or let's say compassion, loving kindness, these kinds of emotions are to be detached and practiced with equanimity and directed towards all beings alike. I guess, you know, my main issue is that they shouldn't remain abstract. You know, what does universal love actually mean? True universal love, in my opinion, could only be built out of the union of all particulars, right? So it's not something abstract that floats above particular relationships. It should properly be built out of the union of all possible particulars. And that would be a way of describing it where the mother-child pair, which is one particular, the earliest particular and the most intense particular of all, could maybe be a basis for gradually turning into something higher. So what strikes me, the masculinizing part of this that I'm talking about, is the tendency to turn universal love into an abstraction. This is something I mentioned in my book that a friend of mine pointed out to me, which I thought was such a great image. She said, think about the thousand-armed image of Avalokiteshvara. Right? Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva who embodies universal compassion. But how does he embody universal compassion? Through those 1,000 arms. Universal compassion as the union of all possible particulars. Not as something abstract and disembodied that floats above all actual human relationships. That's kind of what I'm trying to get it. Okay, so Bhikkhu Anali, so Majjhima Nikaya 87. So I should go back and look at that. I don't know that off the top of my head. Okay, Kara Dibdin. Seems like women are often seen as coming from the point of view of wanting to be mothers. In the Anguttara Nikaya, I think it depicts the Buddha saying that women desire sons. Is there anything mentioned specifically about women who don't want children from the outset, as opposed to those who become detached after their children's deaths? That's a good question. I mean, there must be. I mean, some of you might know better than me off the top of your heads. Well, there are definitely examples of Buddha Kapalani, for example. She doesn't have children, right? She gets married and they don't consummate the marriage and they immediately become nuns. So that is interesting. I guess, though, I'm not aware of anything, any text that really says that explicitly, though. That would be interesting to trace. Is there any specific talk about women not wanting children? That's very interesting, and I don't know. Okay, Clara Lynn Nunemaker. What are the different Pali words that are commonly translated as love? Metta, obviously, and you mentioned karuna, but are there others? Well, again, something like tanha, or maybe raga. I don't have my thing in front of me. But various words indicating love in a more negatively tinged sense as attachment. Ravi Chandra Kumar Vijayan, is it the breaking away of conceptual interpretation? I'm afraid I don't really understand that question. Deva Priya Ghosh, thank you, madam. Is there any reference of father love to their son in Buddhist literature? Well, I'm sure there are. Of course there are. But my impression is that in general, it is the mother that tends to be surrounded with these intense emotions and these eroticized emotions of love. But yes, I'm sure there are references to and descriptions of fathers' loves for their sons. Okay. Reading your article made me wonder whether the goddess cult in Buddhism perhaps arose in continuity with earlier aboriginal traditions, which were perhaps matriarchal traditions. However, other religious traditions in India were patriarchal traditions. Could we look at the ambiguity of mother love in Buddhist texts by taking these two strands into account? But I don't know whether we have any evidence for matriarchal cultures in early India. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't posit anything specific as a kind of evidence of matriarchal traditions. The point I was trying to make is that, you know, when you move to a folk level of religious practice, like South Asian folk religious traditions, I think it is very likely that those traditions, being little traditions, right, rather than great or elite or Sanskritic traditions, are simply going to be more accessible to participation by women. And that is a way for women's concerns and women's voices and women's unique perspectives to be represented. But I wouldn't go so far as to point to matriarchal traditions. Okay. Bhikkhunali, regarding the reference to the so-called Metta Sutta in the Sutta Nipata, I think the passage is not about a mother's love, but much rather about the protection she would give her only son. This is a small, but I think significant difference, since metta is in the tradition considered to have a function related to protection, paritta, not a form of mental attitude similar to a mother's affection and love. Well, that's interesting. I will have to go back and look at the original and consider, you know, how I've translated. Tata Loka Bhikkhuni, yes. Clearly there is also, yes. Anukampa and Pema, yes. Okay, anything else or I guess we're just about out of time. All right. Analia says, thank you very much. Yeah, I actually am in the middle of a teaching term and have to run off to class. So I will end things here. Thank you very much. Good questions, lots to think about, and thanks a lot. Okay.